Welcome, teammates, to episode 40 of the Perigee Podcast. I'm your host, Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force, John Bentivania. And today I want to share with you a conversation that I had with retired U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Dave Armstrong on his podcast, Moments in Leadership. In this episode, we discuss navigating the transition from being a team member to becoming a team leader, learning to lead within your scope of responsibility, and the importance of being an authentic leader. I hope you get something valuable from listening. Thank you.
Welcome, Chief Master Sergeant Bentivania. You have another name that you go by, but before you get into that, to orient some of my Marine listeners, you know, we're sticklers about the full rank in the Marines, right? And I'm curious, do you go by Chief? How, when someone walks by you in the hallway, what do they, how do they say hi?
Chief is normally how they refer to me, but normally when I do my full rank, it's Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force, Bentivania.
Right, which is exactly what a Marine would say to you, by the way. Just
that's a mouthful. That is a mouthful.
Yep. Right. Yep. You could have three hyphenated last names and you'd still get the whole thing after Marine.
Yes,
but
yes.
But if you're a Command Master Sergeant not of the Space Force, there are other ranks like that too. Would they also go by Chief? Is that the common?
Yeah, so the E9 grade within the United States Space Force is Chief Master Sergeant, and the abbreviation would be Chief.
Okay, so not Command Master Sergeant. Why am I getting that mixed up?
Because
the Navy does it. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's right. So yeah, so Chief Master Sergeant.
Right.
And so Chief is normally how they refer to people in the shorthand.
Okay.
But my long title, my official title, what it says on my CAC card, is Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force.
Okay.
And so I'm the only one.
Great. Tell us about the other name you go by, though.
Well, you know, Chief Master on the Space Force, Bentivania, that's a mouthful.
Exactly.
So Bentivania is not the easiest name to say or to spell. I'm a Jersey-educated kid.
Oh, from where?
Jersey City, New Jersey.
No kidding. I'm from New Jersey originally, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So born and raised right down the street from Statue of Liberty. But anyway, so years ago, I was I think it was an E6, and I worked for a major. And he just could not say my name. And he just got frustrated one day. And he had me stand up, looked at my name tag, and he goes, B1234. B9, that's your new name? When I call it, you come running. I'm like, yes, sir.
Okay.
And it's stuck ever since.
That's a good one, though.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for me to write.
Yeah. Okay. So will you sign off on like unofficial correspondences? Like, hey, thanks,
absolutely.
B9.
That's
or
right.
Email signs off? Sign that's off. Right.
Very rarely, like most of my... you know, most of my counterparts, you have SCAs, you know, like a Sergeant Major Marine Corps, you know, SMA, they know me as B9.
Right.
And General Saltzman, the Chief of Space Operations, usually refers to me either as Chief or he'll just call me B9.
Okay, that's great. That's great. And we were talking earlier about how you know Sergeant Major Ruiz. So,
yes.
He's been on the podcast before, too. He's coming on the end of this month again, too.
Yeah, he's a good cat.
He is good. I'll be interested to see who has better hair these days, me or him, because he's been in his role for 2 years.
I had to bring up hair because, you know, I'm sitting here bald.
I know. And this is not this is not one of my new video podcasts. So for the listeners, yes, correct. But
simplicity.
Yes. That's great. Tell me about your origin story. How did you one day end up, I'm assuming 93, 94?
94.
94.
Yeah.
I assume you wanted to join in 93 and got around to it in 94, or was it an immediate enlistment? Like you were on the bus the next day.
Yeah. So, you know, I was actually in Jersey City. You know, I have a large family, Italian family, and a lot of them were either in the police department or the fire department in Jersey or the Port Authority. And, you know, they were doing well for themselves. They all had side hustles because, you know, you're working a compressed schedule. They were carpenters, electricians on the side. And you know, at the time, it just seemed like, wow, that's a way to go. So I took the policeman's test. I took the fireman's test. But I couldn't get hired because you remember, like, in the early 90s after Desert Storm, a lot of individuals were getting out.
Yeah.
And so veterans' preference, individuals are being hired because they were veterans. So my original plan was, I said, well, fine, I'm going to join the service, do my 4 years, and come back, and then use my veterans' points to get back on a fire department is really kind of what I was focused on. So that's how the journey started. I mean, obviously, there was some patriotism, you know, watching, you know, what was going on, you know, Desert Storm, Desert Shield. And, you know, I thought it could help me mature a little bit, you know? So I said, service sounds like a great idea. My father was a Marine in World War II.
Okay.
He said, hey, like, go grow up, go do something. Mm-hmm. The other part of it too is, you know, I was married before I joined the service. So my wife, Kathy, part of it, you know, Kathy, had a son, our son, Neil. So it was instant family, right? I had a wife and a young son, and I had to figure out like adulting's hard. Like, what am I going to do? What's my career? What's my path?
Right.
So like all these things kind of came together, you know, service, patriotism, a chance to kind of learn a trade, grow up, come back to Jersey and get on a fire department. So that's how it started. And the phrase I say is that, you know, that initial 4-year contract for me, when I got to my first duty station, McGuire, Fort Dix, mm-hmm. you know, in Jersey, my first station's Jersey. You know, that 4-year contract turned into a lifetime commitment.
Yeah.
You know, and it was because of leadership that I was exposed to.
That's awesome. I want to ask you about that. You know, so going back to your early years, what stories can you tell me and the listeners from that junior enlisted phase that still stick with you as defining leadership moments? What were some of the wins, failures, or like what were just some of your hard learned lessons from back then?
I think it was a couple things. You know, like I said, that transition from a contract to a commitment.
Mm-hmm. At what point though, at the 4-year mark, or like, did you know within a year, you're like, I love this.
I would probably say about the 3-year mark.
Okay.
You know, because the first while, you know, you have basic military training, tech school, very structured. But it wasn't until, you know, like we say, getting into the operational service, and for me, it was the Air Force, right? The Space Force wasn't around, where at the tactical level, right, I had men and women that I was engaging with and realized, hey, this actually isn't a job. It's kind of a way of life. It's a profession.
Right.
What started to turn for me was the amount of opportunity and responsibility that they entrusted me with.
Okay.
Right. The empowerment. And I remember, you know, I was a young E4, and we had to drive. I had to go up to upstate Vermont, Burlington, Vermont, from South Jersey, to go do some work up there. I was a maintainer when I first came in, so I had to go work on some equipment for F-16s up there in Burlington, the Green Mountain Boys that are up there. And it was just me and another E4, right? And the master sergeant was like, "All right, you know," taught me how to, you know, get the trailer ready and everything, and said, "All right, going TDY, you guys are there for a couple of days."
Wow.
And I'm like, wait, just like the two of us are going up there, like, and we're responsible to calibrate this equipment and make sure the planes are flying. Like, it just, I cannot believe, right, that, you know, a couple of years in, my ability to have a chance to do these things. So that was kind of the first, like, wow, I never thought I had these opportunities, right? That someone mm-hmm. would entrust me with that. And then on top of that, it was the investment that my NCOs and senior NCOs placed in not only me, but Kathy. You know, like I said, we were kind of newly married when I came. I was only married a couple of months before I went to basic training. So, you know, new husband, new airman. At my first duty station those years, Kathy became pregnant with a daughter, Caitlin. So new father. And, you know, the supervision, the NCOs and senior NCOs, just how they embraced me and Kathy and tried to help us go through that transition. I was like, wow, the investment they're making in me is just unbelievable. And I said, maybe I want to do this for a little longer.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So when you look back on your early careers, what were some of the hard lessons that you learned? What was that moment where you were like, uh-oh, I'm never doing that again, or you saw something, or like an early on?
Yeah, I think when I transitioned from a junior enlisted to a non-commissioned officer, and like we all go through, you know, one day we're buddies,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the next day, you know, you have some responsibility and authority thrust upon you, and trying to navigate that from, hey, I know we're all friends, but I have the responsibility to execute a mission. Right, we got to get something done, a task, whatever it is, and I need to be able to have responsibility and kind of lead you through it. Now, lead is a you know, it's a funny word,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, there, as you know, there's leadership because of just by your authority that you have by the rank, but there's right then the authority and the leadership that you earn, But trying to go through that transition and understand that there's a distinction between, hey, you know, we're, you know, just joking around as a couple of junior enlisted. And then when I become a non-commissioned officer, to be able to, you know, utilize, right, and enforce the responsibilities and authorities that were entrusted in me. So I learned that there was a little bit of a learning for me to kind of get through that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult learning environment across the services, that initial ascension from or into the NCO rank. I know it happens at different points in services, but I think that that's got to be really hard to all of a sudden say, okay, the guys that you were just, guys and gals that you were just buddies with, now you're in charge of. And there is leadership above you holding you accountable.
That's
for
right.
Making sure. And so you've got the pressure squeezing in from both sides. And
yeah.
I got to imagine
that. Yeah. And I remember the conversations, right, in those early years where, you know, hey, man, we were just hanging out at your house drinking beer on Saturday. Mm-hmm. You know, on Sunday, why are you going to make me clean the latrine? I mean, what's got to get done?
Right.
And why are you going to put me in a situation that my friend would ask? And I was like, hey, man, like, we're both professionals. Why would you put me in this situation?
Exactly.
Like, you know, on the NCOIC, like I'm not going to treat you any different. Like, this is business. This is
right.
A profession. So kind of learning through that was one of the first challenges, I think, in that transition.
Yeah. So sticking with the early part of your career, was there something that sticks out to you as a moment where you saw somebody doing leadership right, you know, not just effectively, but something that you saw someone do or be like and said, I want to emulate that person?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. When I became the chief master of the Space Force, you know, we had a ceremony at the hangar on Andrews, and I had invited, you know, an old supervisor buddy of mine from back in the days when I was in, you know, E4, mm-hmm. Mike Yakowinko was his name. And, you know, we had kept touch a little bit, but I invited him to come out. And in my speech, I talked about, you know, the impact that he had on me. Cause you know, he used to call me a knucklehead, right? Cause you know, he saw things in me I didn't see in myself. Mm-hmm. So he would hold me accountable. Like, he would provide me constructive feedback, constructive criticism, to help me be the best version of myself. So it was that, you know, investment, but not also afraid to, you know, pat me on the back when I deserved it and kick me in the rear, you know, when I needed it.
Right. Flip that same question for me and talk about a time where you looked at something and said, like, I have to be different than that. You know, in other words, what did you learn from a bad example?
Yeah. Toxic leadership.
And tell me what that means.
So
to you.
Yeah. So the first thing is, you know, individuals that I think don't treat others as professionals, mm-hmm. or as human beings. You know, none of us are statistics. None of us are numbers. You know, we all come from a different place. What I have experienced and I've witnessed, right, where, you know, why would you talk to or treat somebody, right, in a way that just isn't constructive? Like, it's not helpful. It's not improving morale. There's no reason to do what you know, they're doing. And I would experience or witness that and say, man, like, I don't want to do that. Now, does that mean I've never done it? Absolutely not. I'm a human, mm-hmm. and I have made, you know, 32 years, a lot of mistakes. I have been a crappy leader, you know, at times, right? And you learn from it. So, but you know, you put those things in your toolbox. And I said, I've always told, as I have mentorship sessions, that you learn just as much from bad leaders as you do from good leaders.
Yeah. I remember that was one of the first things my dad told me when I was complaining about one of my senior officers in very early on in my career. He said the exact same thing to me. And he and you are both right about that. It's interesting. I'm curious about if you reflect back on your career, I'll bet you most of your, when you said you were a bad leader, I'll bet you more of that was taking place in the early part of your career than there's this massive learning curve.
Yes.
And so you're making these massive amount of mistakes early on in your career. And I look back, you and I are both products of the 90s. And I think leadership was viewed differently then than it is now. I think there was so much more tolerance for toxic leadership back then, because I don't think that term even existed back then.
Probably not, no.
I just think there's a lot more empathy now across the board. Like, forget the ranks, forget officer enlisted. I just think there's so much more empathy now. I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad it's there.
Yeah, I think it's acknowledgement and how we've come, you know, that, you know, it's art.
Yeah.
Leadership is an art, right? And just, and again, going back to the drawing the distinction between, you know, the rank that is inherent in position and the leadership and authority that you kind of have to go through and earn, right? To really be able to influence that.
Yeah, I think there's so many things about my previous officer career that I would change early on from my lieutenant days and my captain's days relative to mistakes or things that I look back on and wish I did differently later on in my career.
Yeah. And now, we all have our different leadership journey. I don't think the journey ever ends. I mean, I tell people all the time, I'm the Chief Master Sergeant of Space Force, but it doesn't mean I have not arrived, right? There is no end of my leadership journey and learning. But, you know, those mistakes, I mean, I can look back at when I was an E7, when I was an E9, when I was Chief Master of the Space Force within the last couple of years, of things like, ooh, that was a mistake.
Right.
Like I've learned something. Because like all of us, right, at echelons of leadership and opportunity and scope of responsibility, you know, it's all, they're all like new pair of shoes, right? You got to figure out, right? You got to break them in.
Right.
And so there hasn't been a lot of, I think for me, seamless and transitions.
Right.
Right. And I think that's what marks us as professionals because, you know, as we progress and assume different roles, we pour ourselves into it. Right. So because of that, because, you know, it means something. It's not just a title, right? So it's just the stripe that we wear, you know, we embody it on behalf of the service. So I think because of that, how we, you know, view that and as professionals, how we pour ourselves into it, you know, there've always been significant changes in what that looks like, what's expected of me. And I think I've stumbled all throughout, you know, my career as I made that transition.
But you've had a wide range of leadership roles.
Yes.
And I'm curious, did any one of them fundamentally shape how you lead today?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So I was a young E7 and I was trying to retrain. I was trying to become a first sergeant in the United States Air Force at the time. I was still an airman. And my commander at the time was an O5. You know, said, came to me and said, look, if you want me to support you to try and go off and do this other thing and become a first sergeant, I'll support it. If you pull your paperwork back, I want you to be my senior enlisted leader for the organization.
Right.
And I was the youngest master E7 in the organization, but this commander saw something in me that I didn't necessarily see in myself and wanted to put me on a command team and help him lead the organization. So one, it was like that individual, Todd Frias is his name, taking a chance on me, giving me an opportunity, changed, again, gave me a phenomenal, and so, man, and again, leadership kind of allowing me to take a risk. But what I learned, because I was a junior NCO, I was terrible. Like, I the other individuals that are supposed to be, quote-unquote, leading, were walking all over me. Like, I had no confidence in myself. I was not effective at setting expectations and enforcing them. So I struggled for a bit. I struggled, and what happened? We were in Fallon, New Mexico. We were TDY, and we're setting up because I was an aggressor. I was a space aggressor, and we're setting up the kit to help support the Navy do some training on the Fallon range. And we get there, and so I'm the senior enlisted leader for the organization, and I happen to be like one of the leads on the team and on the field. So we get there, and we're trying to set up, and man, people are smoking and joking, like no one's kind of doing what we got to do. And one of the individuals who was a contractor on the team is like doing the same thing, like he's just popping jokes on me, and I remember calling this individual. I said, come around the side of the tent. We're gonna have a conversation. And I was like, what the hell's wrong with you? He's like, you know, I'm trying to put some organization and discipline into this group. And you're just following into him. Like, I need you to just shut the hell up, right, and let me do my job and stop throwing fuel on the fire.
Right.
Like, I need your support. Now, this guy was a reservist, and he was a chief as a reservist, but he was in his contractor role. And I'll never forget, he looked at me and he tapped me on my chest. He goes, "Now you're a senior non-commissioned officer.
Wow.
Now I got your back."
No kidding. That's right? A great story.
Yep. Because, like I said, I didn't have the confidence, and I just, you know, you don't want to follow someone who just reeks of fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
And because I had imposter syndrome, right? Because I was young. You know, I looked up to these individuals because they had more time in gray, time in service than I did. They had been other places. But the commander chose me, asked me to do it. And I just was able, until I finally started standing up, right, and having some confidence in myself. And then I started to gain the trust and the respect of the team. So that was a very significant leadership lesson for me.
That's really interesting. You've also, you know, because you've transcended so many different roles, was there ever a point where you found yourself where you had to rebuild a team or rebuild a culture? And
yes.
Okay. Tell me about what approach you took and what did you learn about influence at that level?
Yeah. I think that, you know, as leaders, right. And I use this for the time. We're all leaders in our own right. Whether you're a young E4 and you got a couple other junior enlisted, right, on a fire team or on a crew, right? Someone's the leader.
Right.
You know, whether it be the formal or the informal leader, someone's got to do that. And, you know, in organizations where, you know, an unfortunate event happens to occur, whether someone gets hurt, we lose somebody, toxic leadership. I've been in organizations where commanders have been relieved of command.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you rebuild, right, the morale and rebuild the trust? And again, I think it's, you know, portraying confidence, right? Reaffirming, right? The value of the team, the value of the mission, the value of the individuals. And that in our business, right? Things happen, but as professionals, right? The nation expects us to get back off the floor, dust ourselves off, and we got to press.
Right.
It's not like national security can take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think what I've learned in those challenging times when I have to rebuild a team is going back to the fundamental basics, right? Of who we are, why we wear the uniform, why we come to work every single day.
Right.
Let's focus on the brass tacks.
Yeah.
And start to rebuild from the first brick up. And I have found that kind of helpful as we kind of go through that.
Yeah, interesting. Enjoying moments in leadership? Help the project get more guests and reach more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It takes like 5, maybe 10 seconds to do the reviews. And it really helps me to continue bringing on inspiring stories from senior military leaders. Additionally, you know, when guests see that it's popular or hear about it in their commands, it helps me get them on as guests. If you're able to chip in a little bit to help with the project, please head over to my Supercast support page at mil.supercast.com or through the link in the show notes, because every little bit helps. Now back to the episode. When you look back over your times, specifically you had a role in Space Operations Command, what stands out as a real leadership growth spurt, like a stretch moment that made you sharper?
I think from a growth moment, one of the challenges when you become, in my opinion, when you become an E9,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I became an E9, you know, in the Air Force, my first job was with an 06, with an 06. But then, you know, you work with an 06 for a little bit, and then your next job could be with a 3-star.
Sure.
Or a 2-star. And you think about, you know, that officer has had years of development, education, experience, right? And I get 10 days to drive across country. That's my next presentation. So I think, you know, that growth spurt and trying to keep up, like I remember going from the installation up to another level. And, you know, at the installation, like I'm worried about driving on my yard on my installation, right? I'm looking at potholes on the ground. I'm looking at, you know, trash that's by the fence, you know, whether my defenders at the gate are looking sharp, you know, whether or not the treadmill in the gym is working, like it's my house.
Right.
Then I go up to 3-star level, right? We're talking about national security strategy, talking about the budget, right?
Yeah.
Like my 3-star boss, who I'm looking to advise, if I bring to the table, hey, I saw somebody, man, they didn't have their hat on coming in. Did you see the pothole? And they're coming in. Like, that's not the level of leadership I'm looking for. So it was when I first made that transition working at the GO level, was listening in the meetings, and like, all right, I got to read this document. I got to understand what was that phrase? What is the FIDEP? What's the POM? You know, what is the president talking about? What's the Secretary of Defense talking about? And that was a growth spurt for me and reaching out to my peers like who've been doing this. I think I'm a little out of my depth. Like, I got a depth. I got to figure out. I have to be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, none of us are token E9s, right? We have to be at the table, relevant, to be able to have a conversation and provide the advice and counsel as we do, especially as senior NCOs, that are helpful to our teammate, our boss.
Yeah.
Whether that be at 06 or an 09 or an 08. Right? So that kind of was a growth spurt for me as I tried to transition really from the operation to strategic, sitting around the table of those kind of discussions.
In the Air Force, a squadron is led by a lieutenant colonel, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so is there an E9 at the squadron level or?
The Space Force, you know, you said Space Force, right?
Well, I may have, but now I'm curious about both.
Yeah, so in the Space Force, you know, we're so small. Right now, we're just about a little over 10,000 uniformed guardians. That's officers and enlisted. So we have about 60 E9s.
60. Okay.
Right, so we don't have a lot. So we have, I think, one E9 at the squadron level, and that's our basic military training.
Okay.
All the rest at our squadron level, partnered on the command team with our O5s, are E8s for the most part.
Okay. Got it.
Now in the Air Force, yeah, there are a lot of large squadrons, whether it's the O5 commander, and there is an E9 squadron superintendent.
Okay, gotcha.
Like a maintenance squadron's huge.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
So
I'm curious, going back to where you're saying you could go from working from an 06 to a 3-star general, and you make that, is it a self-reflecting moment where you say, I've got to grow into this difference, like getting away from the potholes and getting towards, you know, the budget? Or is it the general that sits you down and says, hey, I really need you to expand a little bit more of your leadership? Or do you have a peer, an enlisted peer that says, hey, let me pull you aside for a second. Let me kind of tell you how you got to adjust things a little bit.
So I think a little bit of all three.
Okay.
All right. So I did have, as I was making some of these transitions at different echelons, especially the big leaps, you know, a peer, a mentor who would try to set me up. But I remember that first time. I remember the talking, but it didn't resonate like how hard, like how big of a jump it was going to be. Like I just couldn't, someone, like they tried to help me out, but I just wasn't, like, I wasn't picking up what they were putting down.
Right.
And I, you know, a little bit of feedback from the general officer, but here's where I think it's really important. As a dedicated professional, the biggest emphasis, the biggest push was for me personally, right? Because I wanted to be relevant. I wanted to be a team. I wanted to be a good teammate, a good advisor, right? I wanted to protect the stripes. Yeah. It wasn't so much about me. It was about, we all work hard to get here. I don't want to be the one that puts us a step back.
Right.
So it was, I have got to represent the enlisted corps. I've got to represent my brothers and sisters who are wearing E9 rank. So a lot of it was just because I wanted to be, I consider myself a professional. I wanted to be able to self-study. Like, I got to ask the right questions. I got to do these things, right? And then I go back to some of the peers who, you know, maybe I didn't listen to originally, you know, and then I'm actually constantly asking the boss for feedback. Hey, is this helpful? You know, what should I read? Where do you need me to go? What do you need me to do? What are your objectives, boss, that I can go out and help facilitate? You know, so, but all three, but I think the biggest one is if the individual themselves does not show the dedication and the pride in the job and the position they're in to be able to spur themselves forward, to be able to climb that ladder, you know,
right,
so to speak. But a lot of it's got to be what's inside you, what drives you personally to do that. Because people could tell you, give you all the advice in the world, but if you're not personally motivated and driven, I don't know if it's going to help.
Yeah. Now you've got me curious about the E8s. So I'm sure there's all formal schooling and everything that goes on here, but
we're building it.
Great. in addition to that, and you can answer this question from either service, but what is it that outside of the formal educations they're going to get, what is it that an EA really needs to understand that is transcending into an E9 role? Like, what's that one thing where you're like, okay, look, you've gotta get this thing right.
Yeah. So I, a lot of times, refer to it as the art of influence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've stood on stage, you know, last 2 years in this position, and I've said, I am the chief mass sergeant of the Space Force. You know how much authority I have? Almost none. I don't have a lot of authority. I don't sign documents. I don't sign policy publications, but I influence the hell out of it, right? So it's as a professional, as an E8 and E9, and you're working with, right, the principals, mm-hmm. how do you use your years of experience and training to influence, to make sure that the mission's being accomplished and the people are being taken care of? I've never shouldered the burden of command.
Mm-hmm.
I've helped carry the rucksack.
Sure.
Right? Alleviate some of the weight.
You've had a front row seat to it.
Right, right. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, how I kind of view myself is understanding that keeping credibility in the office, keeping credibility in my position, so I have the ability to work with my teammates so that when I do say, hey, this is what I think is the best thing for the enlisted corps, mm-hmm. or here's what I think the best thing is, what we should do for our captains, or so like whatever the matter is, my care, my responsibility doesn't stop at stripes, whether stripes, suits, or stars, the chief mass sergeant of the Space Force, right? I have responsibility. But I think, you know, what they need to learn at the E8, going back to that, is that transition at that level, working with command teams, is understanding what you know, kind of responsibilities and leveraging the boss's authority, but inherently we don't have it. But how do we leverage all that credibility that we bring to the table to influence the direction of an organization?
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer. Thanks. I'm curious. So not every E9 can keep going up the triangle, keep going up the ladder.
That's
and,
right.
And in there, just like officers, right? Not every colonel can be a general. Not every one-star right. can be a two-star. But in that, there's got to be some shakeout of failure. There's got to be a few that fail. Is there something that you see as a common thread of people that cannot, they achieve E9, but they don't keep going up and they fail at something? Is there a common thread there or an observation that can be valuable for them to know as they're entering that E9 space?
I think for probably the most common thing that I've seen, and I'm guilty of it in phases as well, is as you go up the pyramid, if you will, mm-hmm. in the organization, is embracing the new role that you're in. And so I'll give you an example. When I transitioned in first time on, and this is on the Air Force side, I became a wing command chief.
Okay.
Right. So that's that working with the 06 installation commander. I was a command chief. Right. And I had just come from a group level, a level below, operations group chief. And I remember when I got to that installation, my commander, we were first starting to do our first deep dives and going to visit with organizations. And we were going to the operations group, which is not the same one, but a like group I had just come from, actually with that commander. We were a command team at the group level, and she brought me up with her to be at the next echelon. And I remember going over, and she said to me, all right, B9, now remember, we're not the group command team.
Right.
Right? I know we're comfortable there. This is not our job.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the wing level. Like, let's use our experience, right? But this is their command tour. Don't do their job.
Wow.
I need you to think up, right? Not where we're comfortable. So I say that is because I've seen, I think some of us, we get to a spot where we're very happy, very comfortable, and then we're asked to move on.
Yeah.
We just can't let go. Like, we just want to keep right at that lower echelon, that other job where we're comfortable.
Right.
Right.
And experience.
That's right. That's right. And we're uncomfortable maybe looking up, right? And thinking about broader things. You know, General Saltzman he's the chief of space operations. A lot of times, you know, working in the Pentagon, he'll say, you know, we're here to make policy, do staff work. It's boring. Like, staff work is not, like, a lot of us are all operators at heart. Like, we want to get down, not our job. Like, yeah. What the service, what Guardians need us to do is to do policy, right? And write programs, right? And set expectations, right? Fight with, you know, fight for resources, not go down and tell them how to do their operational job. Even though we love that, we love their time, that's not our job anymore. So I think where failure, if you will, or struggles is where individuals don't embrace when the service asks them, I need you to go do this, right? Get out of your comfort zone, go do something a little different. If they don't embrace it and understand that and keep wanting to go back, then they struggle. And I guess failure is a strong word, but I would definitely struggle and have challenges.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm glad I asked you that question, because that's a great answer. And I think it's valuable for somebody listening to this that is moving up to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm probably guilty of it myself.
Yeah. I mean, especially non-commissioned officers, mm-hmm. right? And senior NCOs. We love our people. Like, I am no happier than when I'm out and about surrounded by my Guardians,
right?
Right. Of all ranks, right? And just what's really happening, right? How the successes they're having, the challenges that maybe I can help them with. But I remember when I was at the 3-star level, mm-hmm. right? And I went out to, I was in Vandenberg Space Force Base, it was Air Force Base at the time. And just, I was a, you know, headquarters organization on an installation. And I remember getting there. And at first I was like, man, you know, brand new base. Like, I want to go visit the security forces and I want to go visit. And one of my peers said, hey man, that's not your job anymore. That's somebody else's time. Don't take that away from them.
Right.
Right. And I would always get the, hey, we're doing like a promotion ceremony or something. Do you want to speak? And I'm like, nope.
Right.
No, I'll be in a crowd, but I'm not going to speak. This is your time.
Right.
This is your command. This is your house. Like, I'm a guest in your house. It's hard. It was hard for me to do that because I loved, right, going out and
right.
dropping by. You know, you drive around base, like, oh, let me just pull in and say hello to the troops, right?
Yeah.
But I had to keep going. Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
I ask that question to a lot of guests, actually. I tend to ask more to the general officers, because I put myself in there and I say, like, you know, if I was just driving down the base and I saw a bunch of Marines working on a truck or something like yeah. that, I'd want to just get out of the car.
That's
like,
right.
What are you all working on?
That's right.
And the answer I get from every single one of them is, you cannot do that. Because the minute you do that, you start this whole dust storm of, you know, hey, what did you go? And everybody thinks, what's he doing there and all that yeah. stuff. And my friends have all said the same thing, that it's one of the hardest things to do is to not do it.
Yeah.
And when I asked one of them, I said, but you got to get out there a little bit.
Yeah.
And he said, my secret there is right before a meeting starts, I'll say, okay, I need to use the head real quick. And nobody's really going to escort me to the head. So that's when I get to go out there yeah. and like grab one or two people in the hallway, just ask them how they're doing yeah. and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. Because we use it as leaders, right?
Right.
We use that to refill our cup.
Great way to put it.
Right. And so I need it. But I also try not to abuse it.
Right, right. Interesting. You know, is there a piece of leadership advice that you used to believe a long time ago that you now no longer subscribe to or believe in?
Yeah, I do not have all the answers. I'm not expected to know everything. And this kind of happened when the mentorship I got when I became an E9, when I became a chief, and you know. At the time, one of the traditions, and we still do it in the Space Force today, but you know, when the E9 list comes out, they call it the chief bus. So
okay.
Yeah, so everyone on an installation, all the existing E9s will get a bus, you know, from LRS transportation, and they'll go around all the organizations, pick up all the new selects, right, and congratulate them, and then they'll go off to the bar or go do something, and I'll have kind of a mentoring. You know, okay. kind of session. And I remember.
You call that what? You call get ride?
Well, the chief bus.
The chief bus.
Right, because yeah. there's all the chiefs and the new chiefs. And I remember when I first pinned on, when I first got selected and I was a chief, them, you know, telling me, you know, top 1%, like all that stuff. Like, you know, as we're coming up on a list, right, you look at chiefs in awe. It was like, hey, welcome to the team. first of all, you're not alone.
Right.
Right. It's not like you're the only chief of the United States Space Force or United States Air Force, right? You're part of a team here, right? So you got people to the left of the theater out of you. Don't take this on by yourself. The other thing was, just because you walk into the room and you're the chief, don't feel the pressure that you need to know every single answer. You don't need to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to know is who to call.
Mm.
Right? You need to surround yourself with people who can, right, help you in your weak spots, complement your strengths. But also, right, as Chief said, we kind of, network. But as a leader, you don't need to have all the answers, but you got to be able to know when, hey, I don't know that, but I know somebody who does.
Right.
And I know that I can rally a team to get that answer. I can rally a team to get that done. I learned that there was something I learned, as I kind of assumed I just had to do it all on my own. I was like, no, that's not the case. It's okay to say, hey, I can't do that or I don't know it, but I can lead us to success.
Right.
And bring in the talent and the experience that I need to do it.
I love that answer. That's great. If a young guardian asked you, what's one leadership lesson you took way too long to learn, what would you tell them?
Be comfortable in your own skin.
Okay.
Don't try to be somebody else. We started this conversation about, leaders especially in my younger years, who influenced me, mm-hmm. right? The good and the bad and the ugly. A little bit was like to emulate, like, how do I be Master Sergeant Jones? Or how do I be Captain Jones? Or how do I don't need to be anybody. I just need to be B9.
Right.
Right. So, I am a collage of 1,000 individuals who have put their fingerprints on me through 32 years.
Yeah.
I'm not any one of them. I'm all of them. So I think one of the things, the advice is, you got to stay true to yourself. To be an authentic leader, you got to know yourself. Know your strengths. Know your weaknesses. What are your values? What are the things that you are unwilling to compromise on?
Mm-hmm.
What is the type of organization and culture you personally want to create? Don't try to emulate somebody else.
Right.
We all do, especially in the military, every couple of years we're moving, right? And a leader will leave and another leader will come in. And just because one leader had, this was kind of the climate that they created, good, bad, or ugly, and how they did things, it doesn't mean that's how you have to do it. Like, don't try to be somebody else. You be you. Be comfortable in your own uniform, in your own stripes. Continue to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Continue to analyze and be self-reflective. But I think that to be authentic, and I think to build credibility, you got to be yourself, but learn as much as you can, but don't just try to pretend that you're somebody else.
Right.
I think that's it's a bad leadership approach.
I find it fascinating. You just said something that reminded me. I find it fascinating that people don't really grasp the gravity of the influence that they have when they spend, I'm just going to use it, 30 years in the service. Because if you think about it, it's not just the people that you work with for 30 years that you have an influence and an impact on. It's the next 30 years of people that are left after you leave, because you are ostensibly having an impact on an E1 and an E2 right now. And by the way, your future replacement is probably an E1 or an E2 right now, right? Just certainty.
That's right.
Maybe an E3.
That's right.
But when you spend 30 years in the service, you not only have an impact on everybody that you touched for 30 years, but everybody that they then touch their 30 years. And it probably washes out of the system after that.
The ripple in the water, right?
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. And so the NCOs now are being impacted by you and other senior non-commissioned officers and the officers as well,
that's right.
too. But then they're having an impact on the E1s and the E2s, who, by the way, one of those people is going to be your replacement someday.
Yeah, I think that's another important nuance about, leadership philosophy,
mm-hmm.
is that influence, right, as a leader it's not my job to make sure that I'm leading every single person and within the Space Force, right? There's a responsibility, right, of the E8s, E7s, the E6s. At each echelon, you got to make sure as a leader, you're pouring in, right? Don't, you can't leap over or negate, right? And because you got to go replacement. Like, you may love influencing the young E3s, but they're not going to replace you next year, right? It's going to be an E8, right? So, sometimes it's not as much fun trying to mentor and develop an E8 as it is an E3. But that's, as a leader, right? You have to be able to not just, you're not climbing a ladder anymore, you're building a ladder. So don't, you know, one of the things when you get to this echelon of leadership is don't be a ladder builder, don't be a ladder climber, be a ladder builder.
That might be the title of this episode.
So,
yeah, that's great.
And actually, that's John C. Maxwell.
Is it really?
Yep.
Okay. I like that. So next question, I'm curious, in your State of the Space 2024 message, you talked about how the Space Force has scaled really quickly and is, your quote, really busy. And you've seen the pace ramp up in just a few years. What leadership lessons did you have to learn or even relearn to keep up with that kind of operational growth?
Yeah. I think as a leader personally, and then the leaders, like, you know, that I'm leading, the message has, we have to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Okay.
Right. Reevaluate, you know, as military professionals, you know, risk analysis, how much risk are we willing to take? You know, I mean, we start learning about that very early in our career.
Yeah.
As small as the Space Force is, as fast as we're trying to go, that analysis and calculation is a little different than it was, you know, a couple of years ago.
I bet.
Or when I was an airman. So part of that is what I learned is that we have to be more comfortable with accepting risk, empowering, right, the men and women that we lead, embracing what we learn, you know, failing forward, right, which isn't always something that as a department, as military professionals, we do well. You know, we don't, failure sometimes is not smiled upon. But when you're kind of in a startup like we are and you're moving fast and you need to be innovative, failure sometimes, hey, what did we learn?
Right.
Right. Hey, you were a leader at Echelon and you took a risk and you took smart risk and it didn't work out, but it was smart risk and you learned. I'm not going to fire you. I'm not going to yell at you. Hey, what do you need? What'd you learn? Let's try it again. That's a different philosophy. Mm-hmm. That's a different level of comfort. That I think what I've learned, right, is how do you embrace that? More importantly, you know, how do you kind of propagate that thought process along all echelons? You know, General Saltzman and I talk about this all the time. Sure, we could talk about it in the halls of the Pentagon on an E-ring, but how do I make sure that you know, O5 and EA command team are thinking the same?
Right.
Right? So it's about how do you kind of message that and kind of have that kind of culture allow you to fail forward and move fast? Accept reasonable risk and learn from it and help the service propel forward at a speed at which the nation demands it.
Do you think that's more about teaching young leaders to understand the difference when we talk about risk? I feel like there's two components of risk. There's possibility of something bad going on and probability of something bad going on. And how do we teach young leaders to understand? I'm just going to make up an example off the top of my head. Ready?
Yeah.
Let's just say that there's a field operation going on and refueling is a really important component of it. And the whatever regulations say that the fueler can't go out there unless it has the safety placards on the side. So somebody says, we're shutting the whole exercise down because we don't have the safety placards. Whereas another leader may say, like, okay, the possibility of the truck having a catastrophic event exists, but the probability of it happening because the placards aren't on the is probably pretty much zero. So let's roll without the placards and I'll deal with the aftermath of that.
That's right.
How do we teach leaders to sort of distill that down into making good decisions in any other way than just saying, like, look what happened last time this happened, which is kind of how we write our safety regulations.
Yeah, that's right. And you just said that. It's, you know, looking at the instructions, right? What's the spirit and intent of what it's trying to, right? Rather than saying, well, it says here, can't do this, right? Now, that's just like one of those life and limb, your cautions.
Sure.
But, you know, sometimes we get so wrapped up with, well, the policy says, or the regulation says, or the checklist says.
Right.
Rather than, well, the point, right, the guidance and intent, the spirit and intent of this is X, Y, Z. And as a leader, I'm going to make the right, I'm going to evaluate the risk and make a decision, not just fall back on, I don't want to make a decision because it says in black and white what I can and can't do.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, the mission, you know, function over mission, right? And the mission doesn't get done. So how do you, you know, incentivize leaders at all echelons to feel comfortable, right, with through mission command, if you will, understanding the left and right boundaries and maneuvering in there and understanding the spirit, understanding how to analyze operational risk management, if you will,
right,
to make those decisions. It's a constant discussion. I think, you know, the best way for us to do it, we're trying to incorporate it into at the most junior level exercises and operations, right? Throwing in problem sets that makes the, let them think through that and see how they do, right?
Right.
Because you got to train the way you fight, right? We could talk all we want, but if we don't ever give them the opportunity to kind of think through that appropriately, get comfortable, that real world happens, they're not going to do it.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a Rubik's Cube because you've got the threat of something going catastrophically wrong and equipment and life being in danger. And then there's the danger of impacting your career.
Yeah.
Right? Which are two totally different things.
I remember I was on a command team with a general officer, and we were talking about innovation, talking about how we had to think outside the box. Resources were constrained. In order to get the mission done, we had to think about it differently. So a lower echelon commander looked at the resources within their span of control and made a decision to do something. The boss didn't like it. And I saw the look on the boss's face as we're going into a meeting. And I said to the boss, I said, look, sir, how you react is going to set the tone for your command.
Yeah.
We have said commanders need to own their mission. We have said individuals need to think outside the box. We have said you got to be good stewards of your resources. So someone took you at your word. They didn't make the decision you would have made. Everyone's going to be watching. How you react is going to set the tone.
That's a great point. That's a great point. We're wrapping up here. I appreciate you coming in today. What didn't I ask you that you wish I had asked you?
You didn't ask me where I did my, you talked about all the training and education, but you didn't ask me where I did my senior non-commissioned officer training.
Where did you do your senior non-commissioned officer training?
Quantico.
Really?
I went to the staff NCO course with Marines. Yeah.
How'd you like that?
I've never done so many pull-ups in my entire life. It was great. So I was an E7, and you know, they have sister service. You can apply for sister service opportunities.
Right.
And I remember at the time, I just happened to come across it on a website that I could apply to go to Marine Corps.
Okay.
So
that's our senior staff NCO Academy?
Yeah, so I was over Gunnies.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's just staff NCOs.
Staff NCO Academy. Okay.
And so I applied to go. And I remember I was in the Air Force at the time, right? And I remember there's an airman at the our personnel center who managed this. And I remember calling me up and said, all right, are you ready to do this? Like, it's literally said, do not go there and embarrass the Air Force.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like,
right.
Like, can you run 3 miles and do pull-ups? And I remember I said, well, maybe I'll take a later class date.
Yeah, just to kind of get ready.
That's right. So I remember doing that. And the more people were like saying to me, like, why are you doing this? Just go to the Air Force school. Like, why? And they started questioning my ability to kind of get through it. And it started to scare me. And then it got to the point where I have to be able to challenge myself. Mm-hmm. And so the more it was, why are you doing this? Aren't you afraid to go? It became, yes, that's why I have to go. So it was great. You know, I went and I had a lot of good teammates, but it was so, for me personally, to see how the Marine Corps, the expectations they put in their gunnies, the training, discipline, care, and feeding of their Marines. You know, I was coming from the Air Force, so it was a little different. Like, you know, in my formations as a space operator all those years, the officer enlisted ratio, a lot of officers,
the Air Force.
In the Air Force, even in the Space Force
that
today.
That makes sense.
Even in the Space Force today. So to get a chance to kind of see, right, that culture, right, that, you know, how they looked at that responsibility was really meaningful to me, because I brought that back as a senior NCO and, you know, how I viewed my role in what it meant to be a senior NCO based on what I learned at the Staff NCO Academy at Quantico.
Did you have to take the Marine Corps PFT?
I did. Get it. So literally show up on day one.
And probably CFT too, right?
We weren't doing the CFT. This was back in, no, I can't remember the year. 06 maybe.
Okay.
But you showed up, check, you know, got my room key, had to put on my service dress uniform, go check in for dress inspection. Then had to put my PT gear on and how to do waist measurement. And there were several Marines that didn't pass the body fat.
Yeah.
Got sent home.
Oof.
And like day number three, we had to do the Marine Corps run. And I remember, I'll never forget this. We're in there and, you know, we did the pull-ups in the beginning. And it was raining. It was like dumping rain outside in Quantico. And we're all kind of standing around looking outside. And I said, so will we go back to class? And then like later on this afternoon, do the 3 mile run, or like, what do we do?
Oh boy.
and one of the gunnies, right, said, hey, Mass Sergeant, Air Force said they can't run in the rain.
Oh geez.
Oh man. And yeah, we ran 3 mile in pouring rain and down in Quantico.
Yeah.
And I remember, man, my socks and yeah, they taught me.
It's
if it ain't raining, we ain't training.
It's a different pace. The Marine Corps, the 3 mile. Okay. So I'll just tell a quick story because I know we're wrapping up, but I think one of the hardest physical fitness tests I ever took was when I was at Fort Sill or Fort Knox. I can't remember. It was one of the two Army bases, and I had to take the Army. And I think it's either a mile and a half or 2 miles. I can't remember, but it's one of the two. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this would be easy because I'm used to running 3 miles. But the pacing is different.
That's right.
Because your times are shrunk. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, my God, I may not make it in time because I was pacing.
You were training for the other thing.
Yeah. So great.
But it was a phenomenal experience, and you talk about what were the things that influenced me, my leadership, and my time with the Marine Corps at Quantico definitely had an impact on me on a positive way.
What a great story to end on.
Semper Fi, Dallas.
Yeah, oh, thank you very much, Semper Fi. I'm glad you got some time at the Marines. That's great.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. This has been a fascinating conversation. You'll be sure to pass on to Sergeant Major Ruiz.
I will.
And I appreciate the time and the candor, and this has been great. And thanks for being my first Space Force guest, and or Air Force. And hopefully this will get around to some more of the commands and they'll get to hear your stories about leadership.
I appreciate it. This has been a great conversation. I kind of thought, they said this was kind of a chill discussion. I thought you'd have a glass of bourbon something.
So for listeners, we're in my the Moments in Leadership Global podcast studio, if you will.
Sure, nice.
And I do, maybe I should have some sort of Sean Ryan, you know, have a drink or something like that. Maybe
my stories would have been much better.
Got an idea. Why don't we have you back in a year and I'll have some bourbon set.
All right. So it sounds like a deal.
Terrific. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.